Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. In this episode, we'll feature an interview with longtime political activist Earl Silbar about a campaign called Public Workers Unite and its connections to the economic justice work of Dr. Martin Luther King. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, here's the weekly program of Media and Democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
As more people watch online TV or consider cutting the cord to their cable service, cable companies are getting nervous and attempting to stifle the competition. Last month, Comcast launched its Fancast Xfinity service that gives its subscribers exclusive access to some of its video content online. Xfinity is part of an industry-wide scheme called TV Everywhere, which will put premium TV content only in the hands of those who subscribe to both video and broadband services of a cable, phone, or satellite company. Industry officials are touting TV Everywhere as a great new service for consumers, but Marvin Amore, a law professor at the University of Nebraska and senior advisor to Free Press, says that the industry is actually trying to kill online TV to make sure people keep paying their monthly cable subscriptions.
TV Everywhere is a system to ensure that programmers don't make their TV shows and films available on the internet except to people who've already paid for a cable subscription. As a result, the internet can't be a place for competitors to offer their shows and programming so that people can choose internet services over cable TV service. Under TV Everywhere, you have to pay for both. You have to pay for a cable subscription and an internet subscription to watch this content over the internet.
Amore has written a paper, TV Competition Nowhere, How the Cable Industry is Colluding to Kill Online TV. Amore says that this is a textbook case of an antitrust violation because the companies are colluding with each other to squash competition.
Collusion is sort of the opposite of competition. In our country, we believe in competition leading to lower prices, more choices for consumers, and innovation. We have a strong policy against competitors, you know, getting together into a room and deciding how to set prices without competing against one another and keep prices high for consumers, how to allocate markets so that one competitor takes one market and another competitor takes another. Allocating markets, setting prices, this is referred to in competition law as collusion, getting together, not competing, but making agreements to hurt consumers.
Consumer groups, including Free Press, have called on federal antitrust authorities and Congress to investigate TV Everywhere to make sure that the dominant media companies don't turn the open, innovative internet into a mirror image of the walled-off, exclusive world of cable TV. To read TV Competition Nowhere by Marvin Amore, go to freepress.com.
And now, media reformers offer their wishes for 2010.
I'm Casey Ray Hunter from Future of Music Coalition, and here's my wish list for 2010. I want meaningful net neutrality rules so that the internet remains a platform for innovation, entrepreneurship, creativity, and commerce for everybody and not just the big power players. I want a more competitive and robust wireless broadband marketplace with net neutrality as part of the entire mobile experience. And ultimately, I think there needs to be a greater recognition by policymakers about the value of the American creative sector. We're a huge part of the economy and we're a vital part of the country's culture, and we got to put the focus on sustainable local cultural communities as a way to reinvigorate our struggling towns and cities. And we can pull together on this, but to do so we got to make our leaders aware that this is a crucial part of American recovery.
Hello, this is Tracy Van Slyke from the Media Consortium, and my wish for 2010 is that journalism organizations and funders invest in innovation and experimentation for journalism organizations. This means that journalism organizations can start experimenting with new journalism models, new revenue generating models that can help them reach new kinds of communities, really push forth new kinds of journalism production, and find new ways for long-term sustainability. I also wish that journalism organizations find and build bridges and relationships with ethnic media and different kinds of bloggers and journalists, diversity, people of color, women. This is very important to the future of the kind of journalism we want to produce and democracy for our country.
My name is Hannah Miller, and I work for the Media and Democracy Coalition. And I wish for affordable, high-speed internet service to be a utility like light or water. I also wish that the Local Community Radio Act be passed, so may 1,000 low-power FM stations bloom. I wish that the FCC would make the internet a discrimination-free zone.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
It is almost always up to historians to locate watersheds in human history, to pinpoint that relatively short period of time when accumulated social and economic changes can no longer be denied, and it must be concluded that the society has entered a qualitatively new and different period. The beginnings and ends of eras are seldom recognized at the time they occur. Only by looking back do we gain the perspective to conclude that something world-shaking has happened. 2009 will, I believe, go down in history as the year that Wall Street, shorthand for the finance capitalist class, finally chewed up and swallowed whole the government of the United States. It is, of course, true that businessmen have shaped the laws and policies of the American state since the founding of the Republic, most notably men in the business of slavery and land piracy. When plantation slavery power was broken in the Civil War, manufacturing capital, in league with banks, dominated national life. By the 1950s, captains of industry could still proclaim that what was good for General Motors was good for the country. But sometime in the 1970s, no one can definitively say exactly when, the money handlers got the upper hand over the industrialists. For the first time, the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, the financial arm of the giant automaker, made bigger profits than its parent company. By the 1980s, Wall Street was busily dismantling the manufacturing sector of the United States. Finance capital achieved total supremacy over the Democratic Party under President Bill Clinton, whose operatives abolished all effective controls of the mass manipulation of money. The bankers were now free to create bubbles so huge that when they finally burst in September of 2008, it would require the full faith and credit of the United States to prevent utter collapse of the financial sector. The job of reinflating the Wall Street bubble fell to President Barack Obama, whose executive branch joined with the Federal Reserve to put the entirety of the nation's current and future wealth at the disposal of the bankster class. By July of 2009, Obama and the Fed had committed $23.7 trillion of the people's cash and credit to bail out the banks. In a real sense, it does not matter how many trillions were actually spent or will be sucked up by Wall Street in the future. The point is, the U.S. government in 2009 put everything the people of the United States own or create, or can ever hope to own or create, permanently at the service of Wall Street. Like the young alien in the science fiction movie series, Wall Street has attached itself to the face and body of the nation and is sucking it to death. The picture that best explains the historical significance of the year 2009 is President Obama holding a teleconference with bankers who didn't bother to show up for a meeting with him at the White House in mid-December. Obama is pleading with them to at least pretend to act in the interest of the public whose national resources they have stolen. But the banksters see no need to pay even token respect to a president who is actually their servant. Having swallowed the state whole, they simply digest it, knowing they can come back for seconds and thirds until the people's credit is exhausted. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature an interview with longtime political activist Earl Silbar about a campaign called Public Workers Unite and its connections to the economic justice work of Dr. Martin Luther King. The following interview was recorded on Saturday, January 9th, 2010. We are joined on the telephone by Earl Silbar. Earl Silbar is a longtime Chicago political activist who has been involved in campaigns in a variety of movements, including those involved in movements for civil rights, for union organizing, for adult educator organizing, and anti-war efforts, who is also going to be talking to us about a new campaign called Public Workers Unite. And Earl, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I'll begin, actually, by reading an excerpt of an email that I had received that talks a little bit about Public Workers Unite. Public Workers Unite is an organization dedicated to defending and expanding public services and solidarity in building ties with private sector workers. We are organized around these points of unity: tax the rich, single-payer health, expanding public services, ending the wars, funding public services, stopping privatization of public services, defend existing services and workers' pay and benefits, pensions for all, and improve labor laws. The question I have for you, Earl, is this is a pretty expansive campaign and initiative that Public Workers Unite is doing and taking on. Tell us a little bit about the history of it. How did it begin, and how did you get involved with it?
Well, actually, there was a workshop this summer, actually it was in May, organized by a group called Labor Notes, which runs a magazine and holds conferences every 2 years for people who are active in their unions or want to organize unions but are dissatisfied with the state of the unions. And it's called Troublemakers Workshop, and they had a workshop for public sector workers of all different kinds. We had firemen and city workers and state workers and teachers and you name it. And at this workshop, there were people reporting on various issues that they'd been confronting, including someone who was fighting to keep a mental health clinic open, some clerical workers at UIC who were being overworked and underpaid, and they had to deal with those issues. So we had this workshop that was built around practical issues. And during the course of the workshop, it occurred to me that everybody was pretty much on the same wavelength, that we were being scapegoated for the state's problems and the money spending, the politicians' priorities of Wall Street and the various rich, and helping to bail them out. And then when money is short, they're going to take it out on us and the public that we serve. So we discussed the likelihood. What do we think of the idea of having a grassroots, across union, worker and public kind of support each other and not just lie down and be rolled over? And everybody thought it was a great idea, so we got started, and that was the genesis.
One of the things that Public Workers Unite is working on, and I'd like to talk with you about this a little bit more, an event that is scheduled for January 18th, 2010 in Chicago, an event referred to as the Martin Luther King Day March for Jobs and Public Services. To read from an email that I received, join us in celebrating Dr. King's legacy of struggling for social justice and defending workers' needs. A rally at CTA headquarters, 567 West Lake Street, as I said, on January 18th at 11 a.m. A lot of people, while certainly Martin Luther King is regarded as an esteemed figure in American history and a pioneer in the struggle for civil rights, a lot of people don't know that a lot of his life, especially in the last 3 years of his life, were working on issues regarding economics, poor people, and the working class. You're apparently doing this action in kind of, at least it reads to me, in connecting with that latter and more or less ignored legacy, for the most part, of Reverend King. Is that correct?
That is very correct. As a matter of fact, you couldn't be more correct. We chose Dr. King's birthday for a number of reasons. One is, as you said, Dr. King was very much involved with both the struggle for equal rights, but he was also involved with the struggle of poverty, of people who were impoverished in a system where more and more wealth goes into fewer and fewer people's hands, and more people suffer. And he was very much taking up that and the right of workers to organize. He was in Memphis supporting the garbage workers who were trying to organize in a union, both for economic and social interests. That is to say, they were underpaid, but they were also facing tremendous discrimination. Especially the black workers, of course. So he was involved in that. He was involved in Southern Christian Leadership Conference, of which he was the leader, was involved in organizing a poor people's campaign and a poor people's march on Washington that called for a vast redivision of the wealth of the country so that people would have a right to such things as health care and living wages. And so he was in the midst of engaging from civil rights into some of the broader and deeper issues that affected tens of millions of people when he was murdered. So we are both honoring his commitment and his legacy, but also we feel, in fact, the goals that you just read off are the same kinds of goals in a sense. And that is the unemployment situation. There are 20 million people who can't find living wage jobs, who can't find work at all in this country. So one of our demands is money for jobs, not for the wars. And we want, and not for bankers also, so that facing similar kind of things, Dr. King was very clear. He said, civil rights is going to be easy compared to because what we're talking about is transferring billions of dollars, which was a lot of money in those days, billions of dollars from the hands of the few so that the hands of the many who do the work can actually share in the abundance that's known as America. And so this demonstration isn't purely a memorial. It really arises out of the fact that the public sector is being victimized, that the budget deficits are being taken out on the backs of the people who do the work and who need the services today. In other words, this struggle continues in a different context. And so we want to highlight the focus on the continuity and the growing desperation that actually exists today. So thus, we chose Martin Luther King's birthday. And in fact, on the flyer, we've got a picture of Dr. King with other people in some of the demonstrations.
One thing I've noticed as well, besides just the, I guess, bread and butter economic issues, mm-hmm. the announcement regarding this rally touches on a lot of threats that are being imposed on a variety of public services. Just to read some of them, CTA management, the Chicago Transit Authority, is threatening to lay off over 1,000 bus drivers and maintenance workers.
Correct.
The Chicago Public Schools are planning to close another 25 to 30 neighborhood schools, hand over public education money to private companies. In addition, there is...
caseworkers.
Yes, that's correct. Unemployment, caseworkers, workers who approve food stamps and Medicaid have unworkable caseloads of the order of 1,100 to 2,200 families per worker, far more than they can handle and in desperate help for some need. So it's not just these, you know, abstract issues that kind of leave a lot of people rolling their eyes in frustration, but also a lot of the fact that, you might not be able to ride the bus to be able to get to work, things like that.
Absolutely true. As a matter of fact, the people who are those of us who have taken the lead in setting this group up, Public Workers Unite, which anybody can find at can send us an email at publicworkersunite@yahoo.com. And we have a publicworkersunite.com website that just went up yesterday. So you're absolutely right, though. The people who are involved, we have bus drivers, we have school teachers with the Chicago Public Schools, and we have caseworkers. As a matter of fact, those are the three main sectors of working people who are involved right now, although anybody is welcome. You don't have to be in a union. You just have to be concerned about these concrete issues. And so right now, the CTA workers on February 7th, I believe it, are faced with something like 1,205 layoffs threatened, and the city's the administration that's appointed by the mayor of CTA is using this as a lever to make them give up other things if they want to trade off. Well, you don't want to have 1,100 people fired and have their services diminished? Fine, we'll take away your pensions, we'll take away your health care, we'll take away your job security, we'll give you more work, we'll work you longer hours, this kind of thing. So rather than be facing these things alone, our idea is let's join hands. Let's begin to join hands across union lines, people who need the services. So we have people like who are involved who appreciate and need and rely on the CTA, or whose kids are in public schools. are involved as well are people who are on welfare or people who need food stamps. It's true, by the way. These numbers are accurate. We have a number of caseworkers who are part of this group, and they have people with 1,300 to 1,500 families that they're supposed to help. Just imagine. So it's very concrete. It's very daily life. It's tied up in the bigger issues in the society that I'm talking about, but it's where rubber meets the road. It's where people live.
Counterpose this set of affairs where poor and working people are getting screwed writ large. You discover this kind of counterposing where you just look at what's happened in the situation regarding the baking industry, to mention one example in the last year or so, where some of the richest entities on Earth, probably in world history, had basically gambled away tremendous amounts of venture capital, wound up losing a tremendous amount of it, sent the economy practically to the brink of collapse, and wound up basically given a get-out-of-jail-free card to the extent where hundreds of billions of dollars of money that could have been used for, you know, housing the poor and feeding the hungry and all kinds of good social things are instead being used to bail out people who basically nearly destroyed the economy.
Well, you know, you summarize it very well. That's why we have slogans like money for jobs, not for bankers, fund public services, not the wars, things like that. Because there is a contrast, there is a contradiction, there is this conflict in society. And the reality is that what you're talking about, it's almost uncountable. I've been reading, I subscribe to the Financial Times. I like to know what the wealthy of the world and the big capitalists really are thinking and how they look at the world. And they're appalled at their own system. But being appalled doesn't change anything. And they're going to take it out on us, and it's in addition to people who are poor, who may sound distant to some of the listeners here. If you take the CTA, if you take the Red Line, if you take a bus, if you are a public school teacher or even a public school administrator, or you're involved in any way, if you receive any social services, transportation, all this stuff is on the chopping block now. In California, they fired 30,000 teachers as part of the efforts to balance the budget. But you know what they didn't do? Someone did some research in one of these little socialist groups. They did some research, and I was reading their paper. The 80 wealthiest Californians, if 10% of their collective wealth was taxed and turned into the public revenues, it would pay the entire $12 billion deficit. So it's not that there's no money. It's like, as you point out, there is something like $11 trillion, which is an unbelievable, uncountable sum of money. So that if you took a $100 bill and you put it down every second, 100, 200, 300, and you counted it back, it would take, I calculated, and if I'm wrong, somebody who's listening will have a calculator. I counted back, it's 40,000 years for $3 trillion at $100 a second. 24 hours a day, et cetera, et cetera.
Extraordinary.
As long as human beings are on the face of the earth, that's how much money has been given to these bankers who they were cheating, stealing, lying, and doing all the rest of it. It was a rotten, corrupt deal with these subprime mortgages and all of the paperwork that they did and all the derivatives. So there is this reality that the government of both parties doesn't have any problem dishing out these tremendous, unbelievable fortunes to them. But we're going to have to fight. We're going to have to fight just like people have in generations past, just so that we don't get gored, torn up, and left with no transportation, with gutted schools, and so on and so forth. And that's what we're facing. And so our idea is, let us join hands and use this as a first step. Not that this is going to change the situation by itself, but let's use this as a first step to break out of the business as usual mentality. That's what we're gaming for here.
One obstacle, though, in order to try to continue this struggle that you and others have been involved with Public Workers Unite, is that of a sense of apathy. Let me summarize it this way. A lot of people who may be listening and who have been hearing the story that we've been talking about thus far may nod their heads in agreement as, yep, that's correct, but nonetheless may say, what's the point? A lot of people will go out and, you know, protest the bankers, but they still get bailed out. Mm-hmm. They protest the war, but it still happens and has been going on in Iraq for 7 years and now in Afghanistan in a new escalation for 8+ years. It seems like that there's this apathy and a sense of futility that no matter what anyone seems to do or even millions of people organized may seem to do, it doesn't seem to matter for a whit of difference. When you hear that, how do you respond back?
Well, I think it's very realistic to be thinking that way in a certain sense, because there were millions of people all around the world who demonstrated, I think it was in 2003, when everybody knew the U.S. was going to invade Iraq, despite there being no weapons of mass destruction and it all being fabricated lies. And yet it was ignored and the war proceeded and the war still proceeds. So I think anybody who says, and the bailout's gone out of pace, despite the fact that most people in this country hate it, and especially when they don't have health insurance and so on and so forth, which all kinds of professionals don't have as well as poor people. I mean, my dental assistant doesn't have it, her husband who's a dentist doesn't even have it, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, and when someone starts out and says that, I think, you know, it means you're paying attention to the world. However, because I'm old enough and I go back to the early and mid-60s, people were saying that about the war in Vietnam. Well, it's a war and what can you do? And they fought in Korea and there was nobody, you know, to oppose that and it doesn't make any difference. But the fact is, dozens of people turn into hundreds of people turn into thousands. And what most people aren't aware of is it's not just marches, but there were actions where in those days when they had the draft, when people would disrupt the activities of the draft, there were people in their hundreds and thousands who blocked trains so that troop trains and other trains couldn't go through. There were all kinds of actions. When the Iraq War started, some British engineers, trainmen, refused to drive a train full of munitions, and they had so much support that the government had to unload them and take them into trucks. You see what I'm saying? So in other words, what starts as demonstrations of a few can lead to actions in society that become more difficult for the authorities to maintain their control over everything and thus begin to challenge them in ways that are effective and cause them to reconsider what they're doing, let's say. So what we're looking for is not that one demonstration is going to change the world, but that one demonstration can begin to show that people are serious, that we're taking this seriously. We know there's a threat to our livelihoods, to our services, just as there's been private sector workers have been largely stripped of their pensions. Now they're left with their 401s based on the stock market. Oh, that's great. They lost more than half their money last year. So now people's futures, their old age insurance, their health insurance, their very jobs with these tens of 20 million people who can't find work. So now it becomes survival everyday issues. And we want to be some of the voices that are saying there is a way forward, it is reasonable, it is something we have to spend time and energy and some money to do, but that we are part of a larger situation and that the private and public sector workers together, as we begin to grow and knit ourselves together and develop some trust around common goals that are important to us all. And that's why we have single-payer health care, not this insurance company bill. And we also point towards a political future that's not just more of the same. I mean, here in Chicago, we've got the Democratic Party running things. That's great, huh? Except they run the CTA, they run the Chicago Public Schools, they give away the parking meters, they give away the highways. So what are they doing for the people of the city? It becomes more and more difficult. And so we do not accept the status quo politically any more than we do economically, and we think that new ways have to be forged. And we think that for the people who look back at it and say, you can't do anything, we'd say, well, that's what they told black people in the South. They said, this is the way it is. If you can't live with it, go move out or we'll kill you. That's what the racists said. But you know what? Segregation's not the law of the land anymore. And tens of thousands of people organized and struggled and sacrificed and blocked business as usual and held boycotts. And the same thing is true, the union movements. I was involved in organizing unions. Sometimes we won, sometimes we lost, just as a working person. And the fact is, when you organize and you can be successful, you can force changes. And the same thing is going to be true now because, you know what, just like in the 30s and the 60s, the times are very, very hard for many, many people. And including, if you can imagine, university professors for the University of Illinois are going to lose 4 days' pay. And anybody who makes more than $30,000 as a clerk is going to lose 4 days' pay. That's a lot of money for people who are living on tight budgets. So it's reaching all aspects of society. And we look for this as one step forward. We don't think that a demonstration or a series of demonstrations will change this. But we think as we bring more people together, that we'll be able to be part of a process that many, many, many people, including immigrants and others, are involved in these kind of problems, and we think we have a common future.
That was an interview with Earl Silbar, recorded on January 9, 2010. To learn more about Public Workers Unite, go online to publicworkersunite.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.